joined this afternoon by our friend Mark Freeman. He's a journalist whose work has appeared in Vanity Fair, Slate, and more. Wrote a wonderful oral history of Modern Family, and spent a lot of time, too, talking with the cast, crew, writers, producers of MASH for an oral history a few years back. And Mark joins us this afternoon as we get ready to celebrate the 50th anniversary of MASH. It was so unique at the time. Did CBS suspect that they were just getting kind of a silly slapstick military comedy back in 72?
CBS, more or less, I believe, had very little, if any, expectations, because there was a series which I didn't know about till all this research came up, that Anna and the King, Yul Brynner, was doing a half an hour kind of sitcom version of the movie, and they were banking on that one. In truth, MASH as a movie had kind of galvanized people, and they had reacted to it, and they thought built-in film audience. But they didn't think this was a slam dunk and didn't necessarily have expectations. And they gave Anna and the King the big stage on Fox Slot, and they gave MASH the small stage, which kind of shows you their belief in it. And it's one of those stories, and you'll hear this on certain Cheers is another great example, a show that didn't do so great, in part because people weren't aware of it, bad time slot. But when the summer reruns come around, and at that time, that's all there wasn't any summer programming, people discover it. And then you throw it into that Saturday night CBS lineup, which is probably the best lineup of television in the history of television. And you stick it in the middle of that, and then everybody is going to just react to it and turn like a magnet.
Now, is the story true that it was Bill Paley's wife who loved the show and wanted to save it?
From what I was told, yeah. And that falls right in line with how these kind of things happen. Fred Silverman, there's some stories about him during the process of it, about contract negotiations. So you'll find weird and odd things. But really, if the wife... the head of CBS says, "Hey, this I like this." Then, you know, unless it's something that's really going to cost him and the network money, he has nothing to lose, really, if you think about it.
Should the credit go to both Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds for finding that mix that really wasn't around much in television in those days of comedy and drama?
It really was. So Gene brought all of the television experience. He was very adept, and he had started as a child actor and eventually gravitated over to shows like MASH and then Lou Grant, and he knew how to direct, and he knew how to put a show together, but he was not a writer, and he really, in that sense, was mostly a producer, although he had done directing prior to. Larry Gelbart, meanwhile, is a friend of his, and he had hit somewhat of hard times, which is hard to imagine knowing his career, but he was in London working on, I believe, the Marty Feldman show that they had over there, and the two of them just got together and spent time in London, and Gene flew over to talk about it and figure out, is this doable, how will it be, what kind of tone do we go for? And you'll notice, obviously, when they both leave, the tone starts to shift, and then it's a huge arc by the end of the show from where it started, with the idea that we can't trust people to know where to laugh on Larry's writing, so we'll put in that laugh track, and so on, to you don't need a laugh track when it's a true dramedy in the last years.
Burt Metcalf recently passed away, and viewers may not know the name, but how important was he to the success of the show?
Well, he is one of the... they list him, and when I say they list him, if you talk to anybody from MASH, there is a triangle that serves as the foundation of the show, and we just talked about two of them, and Bert's the third. And what's interesting about Bert is another child actor and a close friend of Gene. And then he became a casting director in the 60s, and Gene brought him on to MASH. He gave him a choice of, because Gene was also handling Anna and the King, and he gave Bert the choice of which show to do, and Bert clearly rolled the dice and got 7 or 11 on that one. So he comes in as a casting director, So there's already a connection to the cast, and then he learns how a show's made, and he's there with Gene. He's there in the writer's room. He's there producing, and Gene recommended him, and CBS listened when he and Larry left, that Bert could take over the show. And Bert had no experience running a show, but he knew everybody then. By then, we're in, you know, number five or so, and so he was the showrunner till the end of the series. So he's really, outside of cast members, the only person behind the scenes of note who lasts the entire run of the show.
And you mentioned his acting. He was in one of my all-time favorite episodes of The Twilight Zone, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
Yeah, you know, when I was in like eighth grade, they made us act out little things in English class. I have no idea why, but we had to do that episode. And I was the guy who I think it was Denver Powell, the guy who says, like, I'm going to go across the street and see what's happening. And then you're out of the whole episode. That was my one line.
Come back and they shoot you. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like Bert. I didn't even know that was Bert, actually, until talking to Bert and researching him online and seeing he had done a Twilight Zone and then looking at it, because it's like, well, he's not Claude Akins. Who else is there of note? And he's that character.
The cast bonded right away, too, and in your oral history, they all talked about the fact that people didn't go to their trailers, that they sat around, chatted with each other, played practical jokes on each other, and that certainly, that came through over the course of the 11 years, that bond was more than just showing up and working together.
Well, you know, obviously the fact that they are still in contact, all the surviving members, and they have this MASH email thread where they tell each other things that are going on. That connection is still there, and you find that in shows, other shows that I've done, Cheers, Frasier, West Wing. You find that connection because you're spending so much time together. But in a lot of those, people do go back to their trailer. Modern Family, another one that I had done, I was on set all the time, and they would go back to their trailer. Sometimes they'd sit down. It just kind of depended on what was going on. But in MASH, they would set up seats kind of like the way I envision it is like director's chairs, somewhat encircled, and they would talk to each other. And Alan thought that was a really important process. He told it to me. I told him my wife teaches middle school drama, and he's like, tell her to do this. And then I saw him on an interview for a background for West Wing, same thing. He was saying about that idea of, if you really want to know somebody and really want to get together, you spend that off time together because you'll see that on screen. And also you get to know people who are cool people. So there's that too.
Yeah. We're talking with Mark Freeman here on Downtown. You write about the table reads and how important they were. And the fact that and so many of the cast were surprised that the writers actually wanted to get their input.
Yeah, because in the typical television setup, the writer doesn't come to the set, really. They didn't have the video villages at the time. So they're told what to do. Here's the script. Director says, action. You do what you want. But this was one of the early examples of a show willing to listen to input from the actors of things they could do. What about if I do this? Or you do it the way the director wants, and then you kind of do, can I do one for me? Which you'll see a lot of very successful programming or even actors telling stories will talk about. And it's not an ego diva thing. It's just there are different ways to interpret a line of dialogue or different movements you can make while doing that line of dialogue. And as a collaborative process, which MASH clearly was, they were very open to that, and not doing crazy improvisational stuff, but they were very open to ideas that forwarded the story, the character, whatever was in the moment. And it's a hard thing to do, but they did it well. And again, a lot of classic shows do it well.
Was it that season one episode, Sometimes You Hear the Bullet, that not only set the tone, but really was the game-changing episode for the series?
You know, when you talk to people and you don't want to lead the witness, you kind of say, hey, what are some of your favorite episodes? And you don't want to say your one favorite because that's kind of insulting in a way. But a lot of them, from in terms of the people behind the scenes, brought that episode up. And it was the first kind of grim result of a close friend of Hawkeye's dying. So now it's like somebody that you kind of know or that you have empathy for because it's connected to the main character. And I'll say this, when I talked to Bert and I had numerous conversations with him, there were a couple times he cried, and that was one of them. And it was just very emotional to him about what that represented. And obviously, he looked back on it nostalgically and favorably, but it still touches him 50 years later, and I found that amazing.
Speaking of crying, so I think the first time I cried watching television, or maybe the second time, the first time was watching The Flying Monkeys and The Wizard of Oz when I was really little, but as a slightly older person, the first time I can remember crying was when they announced that Henry Blake's plane had spun into the Sea of Japan. There were no survivors. Holy cow. What a bold move that was in television at that time.
Yeah, there was a natural evolution of it, which has been written about before, but basically McLean Stevenson was fourth on the call sheet. Alan was first, Wayne was second, Loretta third, and he wanted his own thing, and NBC was promising him potentially the Tonight Show because he did some guest hosting. And as Gene and other people had told me, they were kind of inflating his ego of everything's amazing and you'll be number one wherever you go. So when he decided to leave, and they did everything, cast and crew and directors, producers, to convince him not to, not just for the show, but saying this probably isn't the right move for your career. But once it was finalized, they could have had him just disappear. Kind of like Wayne Rogers, his Trapper John leaving the show. You never see him leave the show. It's just right. It's the episode where you introduce BJ. But they, in the talking about it, they thought this is what war is about, and it wasn't to kill him as punishment so McLean could never come back again. It was the idea of this is real. This is real. This is a statement. And it was never talked about with anybody, as also any MASH fan will know, the extra pages, which were only one or two, and Radar just has the one line, it was given to everybody in manila envelopes, like a secret spy movie, and that's the first time they saw the pages. And so everything that's shot is more or less the actors themselves playing the characters, still responding to the shock of what they've just been given by the producers of the show. So all the emotion in there, they didn't even have time to think of how to play it. It was very natural, which is interesting because you don't really hear stories about, unless it's live television and somebody does something, but in a series, be it a sitcom or a drama, you don't get moments like that where they hold the pages back like that in a last-minute decision. And one other little thing that I think Bert had told me, that when they did it, they got a ton of mail, angry mail, but there was one he even had framed, I believe, but he had kept because it was written by this, I think it was a teenage girl, if I have my memory correctly, but it was one of those comments like, you know, now I know what war means, and she got it, and they stuck by and never regretted their decision, but something like that really, really moved them, that these characters in your living room that are appearing every week, they are connected to you, and they feel like family for that half an hour or when you think about them, and now you just, you know, killed one of them. So that's tough. But everyone accepted it, and the people who got it really got it.
Other series have had to deal with some major cast departures and changes. Cheers, of course, bringing in Woody and Rebecca, and continued to thrive. But my goodness, MASH lost so many key players through the years, but then found these great people and created wonderful new characters. Let's talk about Harry Morgan, who had been on the show before as a general who had gone to the dark side there. I think it was the general flipped at dawn, and then all of a sudden he came in and was so beloved by everybody in the cast.
Yeah, there's certain people that when you do an article or a book or whatever it is, and you hear stories about them, and you think, I wish I could have met him. Mm. I was on the MASH set once, and he was walking off from a scene, and he did this little jump towards me, like, you know, gotcha kind of thing. And I was, you know, whatever, 8 or 9. And it's a nothing moment, but obviously I remember it years and decades later, just the playfulness to him. But to Loretta, he was like a father figure. She just talks about him in amazing ways. He had a lot of industry friends because he had been in the industry since like the 40s. And I know Ralph Bellamy would come by. I was one friend that's off the top of my head. So these industry veterans would come in, and as I said, he was very good friends with them. And he was not—he was coming off of Dragnet, I believe, right? He wasn't—he enjoyed and respected and was appreciative of everything the show brought him and the opportunities the show gave him. And as the senior, in terms of age in the cast, he had experience they didn't have, and with his personality, it just created an environment where, to me, kind of felt like the grandfather, that the good grandfather that you want to spend time with. I will say, as a side note, too, the stories about Larry Gelbart, same thing. Larry Gelbart, nobody had a bad story about, well, this, that time that Larry did, you know, this, there, the other thing. Nurse Kelly, her mother came to the set once, and she had mentioned it to Larry, and Larry took her to lunch and on the Fox lot at the commissary and paid an overload of attention to her. And she never forgot that, but that was indicative of the types of things he would do. G.W. Bailey mentioned some story of
at
the end of Larry's life.
Yeah, he told us this story. It's great.
Oh, you told your story?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and those are the stories that I have that people tell me. And somebody, it might have been Alan, somebody said in a podcast, so I can't verify the truth of this or not, but that somebody broke into Larry's home, and Larry came home and found him there, and ended up talking to the guy, finding out what was going on in the guy's life and helping him to say, you know, you shouldn't lead your life this way. It fits in line with the stories you hear about Larry, but I can't guarantee you that it's a true one. But I did hear it on a podcast from, like I said, I believe it was Alan. So.
Wow. We're talking with Mark Freeman here on Downtown. Mike Farrell came into the show in season 4, and just right from that opening episode to Welcome to Korea, he fit right in and had such a great chemistry with Alan Alda.
Yeah, and that goes back to what you're saying before about you introduce a new actor and you need chemistry. So there's, first of all, do the people like each other? And you can see that on screen. The second thing is Mike was so, looked at the show with such reverence going into it, that he was at somebody's house and he saw it in the background, and he was watching it, started to watch it, but he never thought, I'm going to be on this show. He just thought, this is one of the best shows on television. And Bert apparently knew his work, and Bert reached out to him. And so when somebody comes to you and says, hey, do you want the keys to the kingdom? You want to come on in? He remains grateful to this day. And he loves to talk about the show. And he's a very sweet man, and never has anything bad to say about anybody. And just has these great memories. And he loves to tell that story about that preventative medicine episode, because that's a good Birch story about changing the path of an episode because he didn't believe BJ would make the actions that were written into the script.
Right. That was the episode where they decided to operate on a general so he wouldn't lead his troops back into action, right?
Yeah, and what's really interesting about that story is when I was first interviewing everybody, they talked about this Bible. They got their episodes, the writers, from this Bible, which was a collection of interviews that and continued to the end of the show that Gene, eventually Bert, Larry, they would do with veterans of the Korean War and the Vietnam War. And people didn't remember it. They didn't know where to find it. And I actually ended up finding some of them, maybe like 100 pages worth, and they had said that they would mine through this for anything to inspire an idea. And within the pages of that, this guy tells that story, that there was a general sending people out to die consistently, and that he took out the guy's appendix and didn't regret it at all. And that became the basis for that episode. And the argument that Mike had was, he said, no matter how he felt about the guy and what the guy was doing, BJ would never cross that line to do that and remove that. And Alan Alda was like, well, Hawkeye would. He'd have no problem with it. So they rewrote the script. And I actually have a version that Jeff Maxwell showed me of the original script with the final one, and you can see how they change it from little humorous banter as they remove the guy's appendix to more of a silent, reflective, uncomfortable thing where BJ isn't even there. He wouldn't even be in the operating room with him. And one other little story on that, on the back end, is David Isaacs, who was a writer on the show, said that they worked late into the night to make that correction in the script, and then he came home and it was like 11:30, and he caught a rerun of MASH, and it was more or less the exact same story, but with Colonel Flagg from like season 2 or 3, and he went in and a panic the next day, and he said to Bert, oh my God, we already did this whole episode. And Bert said, nobody's going to remember. And I mean, people did, but they're okay, because one's written by Larry Gelbart, and that's his style and tone. And then you have this episode, and I don't remember who wrote it in the end, but it's also two sides of the same coin.
Now, it was Bert Metcalf that brought in David Ogden Stiers, and that's largely because of what he saw in an episode of Mary Tyler Moore, am I right?
Yeah. So what you typically have is the casting director, and Bert wasn't that by this time, but his casting director head is, who are actors I've seen in plays and other shows and so on that I want to bring in? And they knew they were coming up with a replacement for Larry Linville. They didn't quite know what they were looking for, but they started to have, I think, what became somewhat of a silhouette of what Winchester became. And Bert, who said he would typically go out on Saturday nights, he wasn't feeling well, and he was home that night, and there was this Mary Tyler Moore episode, and in the episode, Lou and Mary are going for a raise, and he won't give it to them. And he, at one point, he's like this stuttering, uncomfortable man.
Right, I remember.
And then he writes this last little, and I had the quote last week, I don't have it right now, but he wrote this last little offer to them, which you don't see on screen, and he says, this is the final offer, and he more or less says, we love both of you, we respect both of you, we want you to stay part of the family, and if you don't accept this, we'll put you in the gutter. And then he walks out of the room. And if you think about what that represents, that is Winchester in a lot of ways. So we saw him and brought him in, and the rest is history. But it also shows you how casting can be so random at times. And the good fortune of David, who didn't even try to do anything. He was just on another show.
The show, for all 11 seasons, was a ratings dynamo, and I wonder if these days the temptation would have been to keep it going. Was it the cast largely that said, you know, we've got to wrap this up while we're on the top of our game?
Yeah, you know, that's the typical thing you get with long-running shows. When is enough? And is it when we're on the downward spiral? Is it when we're still at the peak? Is it somewhere in between? And fans usually are upset when they're still at the peak. And they're also upset that it's going off the air, but if it's not as good, they'll say as much. Well, it was really good those first 5 years, kind of thing. MASH, they were, and that's a long time in your life to do something like that. And for a lot of that show, Alan, because he was such a great dad and husband, and still is for that matter, he would fly home on the weekends.
Right.
He'd be out of there Friday, and he'd be back Monday morning. So there was a lot of stuff going on and a lot of pressures involved. And so really, why not control the end of your story? It is your story. And so they could make that effort to go out on the terms they want, and they wouldn't have to try to squeeze out stories that maybe weren't even true by that point, because they had used up all the veteran stories more or less they had. So when is enough in that sense is, can we keep this train running when we don't have as much track as we used to have? And why not end it? And Mary Tyler Moore did the same thing in that way. If they did the vote, do we end after 7 years or not? And I used to think it was always Mary who wanted to end it, but it was in truth she wanted to stay.
Right.
She voted. I didn't know that until I had read about that.
And the network obviously didn't want the show to end, but also didn't want them to wrap up the Korean War.
Yeah, I mean, eventually what happens is like an aftermath show, which did not work. Mm. If you take away the number one thing on the call sheet, in this case it's the Korean War, then you're taking away the background, the story, the character motivation, ABC storylines for that matter. You're taking away everything, and all you're left with is a group of characters that, in theory, okay, we could throw them into a Walmart and write a series about them at a Walmart, and it wouldn't be the same, because that fear and horror of war and all those kind of things would be lost. So you could say any long-running television series is basically about, in a sense, family, not blood family, but people who form a family and struggle to do whatever they do. But that's not going to always work when you take that group and you throw them somewhere else. And that is in part what went wrong with Aftermath. And Larry Gelbart came back for Aftermath, and they still weren't able to quite make a go for it. But those guys were the ones who had wanted to keep it going. Harry, Jamie, and Bill. So they gave them that opportunity, but now they're just doctors or in a hospital, and there's no urgency to it, and there's no risk that at any moment a bomb could come in or somebody's life is, yeah, you could say it like a medical drama, somebody's life is on, you know, is a baby going to die? But that's a completely different show. And I would say that Gene did that with Lou Grant. He managed to take a great character from one of the best comedy sitcoms of all time and put him in an hour episode about newsrooms and still be that character, but have him work and thrive in a different environment. But that's okay, because both environments are news. They didn't put him in space in one, you know, and have him working at a five and dime in the other. So, but outside of that, that's really hard to do. And if you take away the main core of what the show is based on, you're kind of flailing at that point, and it is a recipe for disaster.
Mark Freeman, great talk with you as always. And next time you're on, we need to talk about your ability to score low-priced, high-quality concert tickets.
Yeah, that, you know, it's a new talent of mine. I kind of thought I wasn't going to be doing concerts as much anymore, but took my daughter to Paul McCartney earlier this year, and figuring she's such a big Beatles fan, I was like, this might be her last chance to see a Beatle. And that went well, and which led me to other shows that I kind of feel like, who are people that I really need to see while they're still seeable, as opposed to that mid-level, or I like small venues, like you were talking about Loudon Wainwright. I'm a huge Loudon Wainwright fan, and I used to see him all the time in L.A., and that was kind of about the size that I enjoyed, something intimate, funny, and with somebody immensely talented. And so, anyway, that's changing now in my world, I guess.
Oh, and I can't let you go without asking you this. Can you give us the short version of the story about your daughter scoring an interview with Carol Burnett, which is an amazing story?
Yes, so she had started, she's going to school to get her BFA in theater, and she had started in her second or third year of high school a club where she would interview industry people, entertainment industry people, on Zoom and post them and just gather and compile. And she had actually gotten a pretty good roster of people, including some of the kids from It and the woman who created Wicked and so on. So, but she was always having trouble finding people because it's a whole process. And we had a conversation, and she was asking me for ideas, and I happened to mention that I knew Carol Burnett had started Vicki Lawrence's career when Vicki wrote her a letter. And I said, well, maybe if we can find a way to contact Carol, maybe she'll do it. So she reached out, didn't hear anything, and then 3 months later, and this is during pandemic, so she's doing her math class in the afternoon on her laptop, and a phone or something came in on her cell phone, and it did not had no identification of who it was. And she answered, and the person said, "Hello, this is Carol Burnett. I'm sorry I didn't call you sooner." And that led to an interview the next day, and she talked for an hour and a half because we were in the room while our daughter did it. She talked for an hour and a half, and would have gone longer, but we were like, "We got to give her a break. We got to let her go." And so then she, it was a matter of taking that interview and putting it into written form, which she did, and then submitted to Vanity Fair, and they loved it. And it is a great article, and nothing to do with me being the proud dad, but it's just a great article about Carol, and it's a great hook of a high school student from another generation who can appreciate one of the greatest comedians of all time, or if you want to call her that. I think she's more than that. And it was just a great conversation.
That's awesome. Mark, good talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for having me.